Today, we're going to tuck into a little bit more detailed analysis. The first 2 weeks were really kind of big picture overviews. The first one was big picture overview of the whole Gospel of John. And then last week, we did this kind of larger scale overview of the whole of chapter 1. And so today, we're going to come back and look at a portion of John chapter 1 in considerably more detail. So, in particular, we're going to be examining what it means for Christ being called the Word, and what it means for the Word to become flesh. That second issue we'll pick up next Wednesday. So, God adding humanity to Himself. What does that really mean? What's the significance of that? It's massive. But before we can really tackle that, we have to establish very clearly in our minds that the person with whom we're dealing with is, in fact, God. And John wants to do that. So what we have in the first several verses of John chapter 1 is what appears to be a hymn from the regular appearance of the text. It's as though someone took a hymn of the church, it's a hymn to Christ, and then put in a couple of extra elements and arranged it in a particular way. And that's not that unusual to really think about. It's not unusual that hymns to Christ as God were sung. More about that in a few moments. But one of the other things, and you'll note this from our introductory remarks, is that as a biographical document, at least in terms of biographies in the ancient world, the prologue to this kind of document would have within it a kind of introductory song of praise that identifies the person that the whole biography is about. Their being, their strengths, their mission, their accomplishments. Very common thing in these ancient biographies. Hymns to the emperor also had that characteristic. They would be sung prior to a drama that was being done on the stage. And so what we find in the first 18 verses of John's Gospel, with a couple of insertions about John the Baptist, is a larger kind of hymn to Christ, or hymn about Christ, which is an introduction so that we're clear about who we're dealing with. And what's important about that from the writer's perspective is this. You already know who he is. Okay, so let's kind of fast forward for just a second. If we go into chapter 2, we're at the wedding at Cana of Galilee. Jesus turns the water into wine. Who sees that miracle? Who actually knows what's happened? Lots of people or just a few? Yeah, it's just a few folks. And then his disciples see and they believe. There's just a few who it says, and they saw his glory and they believed in him. And one of the things that's happening in John's Gospel is this circle of people who see him and see his glory and come to believe in him keeps getting bigger. There's an expanding circle until a particular point where it begins to shrink back down because he says some things that they don't like. That happens to all good pastors. The circle gets here and then it goes here. But there's a growing awareness of who he is. But for you, as the person who's coming to the gospel, you have this advantage. You've read the prologue. So when you come to the story of the water being turned into wine, you already know who this person is. You're not like one of the other disciples or one of the people at the wedding who's a servant who's going, huh. Imagine if the whole Gospel of John opened with the story of the wedding at Cana. And all that's happening is you're being introduced to this person who's got this mother and he's turning water into wine. You would be going, well, this is very, very interesting person, some kind of magician maybe? What's going on here? Some kind of prophet? What? That's not where John does it. He gives you, as the reader of the gospel, the hearer of the gospel, total access to the identity of the person. You know exactly who you're dealing with. So if you were, to use it in that ancient Roman drama sort of way, you're in the audience and you're watching all the action on the stage. The people on the stage doing the drama, they don't know the identity of the person in the play, but the audience all knows who this really is. And so one of the things that's happening here in John chapter 1 is you're getting the full picture of who he is. And it's stunning who he is. How's this hymn arranged? Well, the arrangement of the stuff is not all that important, but basically there were four sections to these ancient hymns to the emperors, divided up into these strophes. And verses 1 and 2 form the first, verses 3 through 5 the second. Then we have the insertion of some material about John the Baptist. And then we come to the third section, verses 10 through 12a. Then a little another brief insertion, and then verses 14 and 15. Then there's some editorial comments down through verse 18. But in essence, what you see here are four stanzas of a hymn. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now I'm going to fast forward with you for just a second over to the second page of the notes. If you turn over there and you look under Roman numeral 2 and letter D, all right? Now, if you've been in some studies with me before, you might have noticed this pattern. And it's based on the Greek letter chi, okay? All right? And this is a literary device which is in several places of the text, of both the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's a very common ancient literary device. Again, Bible wasn't written in chapters and verses, and they didn't have big highlighter pens and things like that. So how would they do how would they draw your attention to something? Well, in Hebrew anybody here in Greg Ward's Psalms class? Anybody do it? David? He'll be emphasizing parallelism and so on as a literary structure to make an emphasis in the Hebrew text. One of the things that's going on in ancient texts is that there's a pattern that where there's a correspondence like this. All right? And it what it's doing is it's leading you to a particular point and then moving back out. And these are in agreement. And when you get to the center of the X marks the spot, so to speak, you've hit the point of emphasis. It's the center point. Here's the central thing you must get. Okay? So you not only have this hymnic structure, which is part of the text, but if you look at it, just the first section here, in the way this pattern works out, here it is. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. This one was in the beginning with God. You see that, how the correspondence of the lines works between them? But what's at the very center? With God and God. So the literary device that's being employed by the writer is drawing your ear and your eye to the emphasis that the person who he's dealing with is with God and God. That's the center point of the whole piece. Now, these kind of chiastic structures will appear in other places, and I'll try to draw your attention to them as we go along. And sometimes they're very, very apparent in English. They show up as well, but sometimes they're more apparent in the original Greek language. Okay, so does everybody understand what that is? I just want to stop there for a second. Any questions about that literary device that's being employed? What it is? Okay. All right.
It's always interesting. You never know that unless somebody like you told me. Yeah. The commentaries don't seem to ever point that sort of stuff.
There are a few good ones, but some don't have that. Yeah.
So, yeah. It's always just kind of like,
yeah. What we tend to do is just take it like this, just line by line, and we don't tend to notice underlying literary structures.
Yeah, you're saying it would have been written to people who might have recognized that more.
Absolutely.
The more obvious.
Right. Yeah. It's not like magic. It's not like a hidden magical code which only like modern scholars can notice, but rather an ancient device which was known to be used. And it's not used everywhere, but it is used in certain places. And again, just to point out a kind of bookendish way that this gets approached, John starts with an emphasis on Jesus being God. And of course, what's the last confession about Jesus in John chapter 20? You have Thomas saying, "My Lord and my God." So you have these both at the end. Well, here's an example in Luke, and then I'll let you guys go find the center point. Okay, in Luke, you find Mary gives birth. She gave birth to a son, and she wrapped him in cloths and laid him in a manger. Okay, fine. But if you come to the end of Luke, it says they took his body down from the cross and they wrapped him in cloths and laid him in a tomb. It's the exact same phraseology. Okay, so they do these literary things at the beginning and at the end, which are not meant simply to be coincidences. They're like big signposts here saying, okay, see, he was wrapped in cloths and laid in a manger. He's wrapped in cloths and laid in a tomb. That ties together the birth and the death. He was born to die. This is what's going on here. All right. So these literary devices are very much a part of the text that's going on. And they start over here and then they work their way to points in the middle where the emphasis is being made. Okay. Now, let's go back over to page one. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but I had to put it in your notes so that you've got it, so that you can use it with other people. And that is, of course, when John says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," the Greek word that he employs for Word is logos, the logos. And that is not something without some Greek and Jewish background to it. John Robertson last week mentioned to us, do you remember what his postcard version was on the Greek summary of logos? What was it? Anybody remember that?
Theory of everything.
The theory of everything. The reason for all things. That's sort of a neat summary of what logos is. Okay, I wanted to break that out just a little bit more and give you a bit of background there. Heraclitus, 6 centuries before Christ, saw the Logos as the thought guiding the universe, a divine cause. But please notice about that, that's very impersonal. It's rather abstract thought. The Stoics, of course founded by Zeno, saw Logos as the universal law. What we might think of as, we would use a term like natural law, what's in the heart of every person. Only for the Stoics, it's not only in every person, it's written across the whole cosmos. And under Plutarch, Logos became identified with the divine mind and with the creator of all things. But in Plutarch, as with all the Romans, the gods are so identified with the created order that they're basically pantheistic. There's really no big distinction between the created order and the gods themselves. They're all made up of the same thing, right? There's not a heavy line of demarcation, though. The Jewish philosopher Philo saw Logos, on the other hand, as personal and bridging the gap between human reason and the divine mind. So, being a good Jew, he recognizes that there's a distinction between the creator and the creature, and that the distinction is not only in terms of essence, but it's in terms of capacity. There's a distance between the creator and the created, and part of that is intellectual. And so there's the divine mind, the mind of God, and the mind of man, and the mind of man is so small in comparison to the mind of God, there has to be some kind of bridging mechanism between the two so they can communicate. It's a very interesting approach to logos. So there's a word. The word is in Jewish thought, is this mind or word from God that stands between God and man and is able to bring them together. How many appreciate that? That sounds like it. We're starting to get into some familiar territory here. Okay, but where John goes a little bit different about this is here. Logos for Philo is not the same as God. He's below God and above the powers. And in Jewish thought, the way this worked out was, and you see this in the book of Daniel and in other literature from the intertestamental period between the Old and the New Testaments, you have, I've already drawn up here, you have God, and then you have the world here and all of us. And between God and the world and all of us, you have a series of powers. The powers. Paul uses that phrase in Ephesians. Talks about principalities and powers. And these powers are ruling on behalf of God over different nations. And so this kind of language shows up a whole lot in the period between the Testaments. The Logos is not God. The Logos is under God, but over the powers, and is the highest created thing that God uses to mediate who He is to the world. All right? So the Logos is under God, but rules the powers and mediates God to the world. He connects God and the world. But He's not the same thing as God. Okay, so He's a mediator between God and man, but He's not God.
Still like a Philo?
Yes, that's Philo. So, very common Jewish thought. So, and what John does, though, knowing that that's the background, means that Philo can pick up on what's called wisdom theology in Proverbs chapter 8. Oh, thanks, Dave. Dave's on it. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 8 for just a moment, because we need to be able to look at this, and then we'll turn to John chapter 1, kind of giving you the background here. So in Proverbs chapter 8, and I want you to listen how wisdom is handled here. Now here is wisdom speaking. I mean, for instance, if you, if you just look at verse 1, for instance, does not wisdom call and understanding lift up her voice? On top of the heights, beside the way where the paths meet, she takes her stand. Beside the gates, at the opening to the city, at the entrance of the doors, she cries out. So now we have wisdom personified. Wisdom is now speaking. So here's the voice of wisdom. To you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. Okay. Now, verse 11. Wisdom is better than jewels, and so on. Verse 12, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. And then let's go over to verse 22. So this is wisdom still speaking. The Lord possessed me, when?
At the beginning.
Of His way, before His works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth, when there were no depths I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills were brought forth, when He had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world, when He established the heavens, I was there. When He inscribed a circle on the face of the deep, when He made firm the skies above, when the springs of the deep became fixed, when He set for the sea its boundary so that the water should not transgress His command, when He marked out the foundations of the earth, I was beside Him. Isn't that, that's very, so there's wisdom personified in speaking. And what Philo does is he identifies Logos with that wisdom, with personified wisdom. Wisdom which stands beside God as He's creating all things and shaping everything. That's what Logos is. Logos is wisdom made manifest. So what Philo, as a good Jew, is doing is he's trying to talk to the Greek world using their language. Their language is Logos, and they have this idea of an impersonal, abstract force of thought or law. And he's saying, you're on to something, but actually, What you are calling Logos, we called what?
Wisdom.
And so I'm going to take your word, Logos, right? And really, the Logos is an assistant to God who stands under God and over the whole world, over all the powers. That's who Logos is, you see. Okay, now with that background, both the Greek and the Jewish background, let's turn to John chapter 1, verse 1, and see how this goes, okay? Because he's going to use their word too. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. Oh, now see, okay, so the first part, in the beginning was the Logos. Would anybody have stumbled? Been startled? No. The Logos was with God. Remember that word with is the same one that's used in Proverbs chapter 8, where wisdom speaks and says, when God did everything, I was what? I was with him. But here's the difference. This is the difference that John's gospel makes. It's in this expression. The Logos was God. Now that's fascinating. So in the beginning was the Logos. Yes. The Logos was with God. Yes. Not telling me anything I don't know here. The Logos was God. What? What? How can God be his own mediator? How can that be? Okay. You there, Dick?
Well, what about Genesis? Mm-hmm.
They use the plural form. Yeah. You're exactly correct. And you're talking about when God says, let us make man in our image according to our likeness and so on. Yeah, that's exactly correct. There was, in Jewish thought, this idea somehow in their monotheism that within God there is nevertheless somehow plurality, right? But still what? One God.
Kind of like a bunch of grapes.
Right. So if you think of it like this, remember that what God is doing with the new covenant and what he's doing specifically in Jesus Christ is that he's bringing to the world the fullness of revelation. That if you take that Jewish... I mean, if you're a Jewish person living under the Old Testament, you read a passage like that, you'd be what? Scratching your head. Going, well, wait a minute. He says in Deuteronomy, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. So how's this whole one and yet our and us thing working? Right? So what happens is in all the ancient world expectation, which is both Jewish and Gentile, suddenly Jesus steps onto the scene. And that's what John's trying to say is exactly coming to terms with the question that you're raising, which is we've got all these questions. We know there's someone there or something there, but what does this mean? What's this look like? So if we come over to Hebrews chapter 1 for just a moment, because picking up on Dick's excellent question, this is and this comes to the fact of progressive unveiling. So chapter 1, verse 1 of Hebrews. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. He is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. Now we'll come back to this. But notice that what is identified here is that God spoke to his people many portions and in many ways. But there's a superiority to the word that is coming now. He has now spoken to us how? Not in many portions and in many ways, but and not through the prophets, but what? By his Son, who is the exact representation of his nature. So there's a new kind of revelation which is occurring. This is God himself coming on the scene. Okay, so what we have is that the Logos for John is not simply a mediator between God and man, but rather he is God himself. And he is saying that he is coming as one who reveals. So let's keep reading here, verse 2. I want to come to that revelation issue. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. I'm reading from the NAS there. You might have slightly different versions of that. In Greek thought, the logos is always associated with reason. Okay. In fact, what word do we still use in our language all the time that takes the word logos and has to do with reason? Logical. It's logical. Okay. It has to do with reason. That's that Greek philosophical background. For John, the issue is not reason, it's revelation. All right? And that's highlighted by the incarnation. Verse 14. Okay, let's look down here at verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we what? We beheld his glory. Now again, Jewish background here, what's glory? The weightiness, the kabot, the Shekinah. The Shekinah. All right. In the Old Testament, when the Shekinah, the glory of God, the glory cloud shows up, how do people react? Yeah, they're on their faces, right? Okay, they're not standing there going, "I've got a question." You understand? See, a good Greek might say, "See, it's a Greek approach to life that says to God, what? I've got some questions." Good Jewish person knows that if God actually shows up, you're not standing on your feet asking questions. You're on your face hoping you can survive the moment. It's a completely different dimension of reality. So nobody could even get on their feet. The glory of God shows up at Solomon's temple. Nobody can stand. What keeps happening? All right. Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John. They see his glory, right? And there. Revelation chapter 1, John, the Revelator, sees Christ in his ascension glory, and he falls on his face as a dead man. These kinds of things are continually happening. So, one of the critical things here for us to understand is that John is rattling some cages here in John chapter 1. He's saying the Logos is not reason. The Logos is what? Revelation. And the Logos is not just someone who stands between God and the creation. He is God himself come to the creation. So this is advancing all of this ancient consideration in a whole new dimension. And so what he's saying is very radical to these people. We're kind of used to hearing it. It's very radical thought to these people. And that this figure, this historical figure, who we don't even see a name yet, do we? I mean, we don't see the name Jesus yet. All we're dealing with is this figure called Logos, who is God and with God, and then is made flesh. There is a person who is the Logos, who is God, who is suddenly made flesh, which means he's walking around here. And this is God being revealed. That's a staggering thought. Okay? So that's what he's doing with gathering all this up together. Now, of course, when we talk about Jesus or the Christ as a divine figure, we might kind of go, really? Really? Do we really believe that Jesus is God? John says that very clearly. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. Okay. And then in verse 14, and the Word, what? Became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Then let's look at verse 18. Here's the emphasis on revelation. Again, watch this. This is a fantastic verse. Dave, you want to read for us verse 18? I love this verse.
No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known.
Okay. No one has ever seen God in his essence, all right? No one. Now, I want to stop for just a second. Did anybody in the Old Testament ever see God?
We've seen Jesus.
Well, see, this is the point, isn't it? I mean, Moses saw his back, right? Yeah. What about Isaiah? In the year that King Uzziah died,
I saw
the Lord. He was high. Okay. Who are they seeing? What are they seeing? Well, they're seeing God. But wait a minute. Paul says God is a spirit and he's invisible. That's good Jewish thought. And he's unapproachable. He's light. He dwells in unapproachable light. And John says here, no one's ever seen God. But it's very interesting in the text. It says, the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. And the word that's used there for...
Huh? It doesn't say begotten in the text, though.
Well, this is...
Yeah. It's a unique God.
Well, see, that comes to what that word begotten means. Yeah, it's what begotten, again, has that meaning of the one who stands in a unique relationship. Okay, so no one has seen God at any time. So let's use that phrase. No one has seen God at any time. But the only God who stands in a unique relationship to God, he's revealed him. He's made him known. And the word that's used here for making him known is exegesis. Now, what's you all kind of been around church a while. What's exegesis mean? Out of, okay. If you heard an exegetical sermon, what are you listening to?
Something that's in the text that they're drawing out of the text.
Yeah, you take what's in the text and you bring it out and you lay it out there for people. Here's this and we're laying it out. All right, and that's the word that's used here for explain. If you heard a good exegetical sermon, what you're hoping that you hear is the pastor taking what's in the text and opening it up and laying it out for you. That's exegesis. Okay, that's the word that's used here. Jesus takes who God is, the Word made flesh, takes who God is, and he lays him out here in such a way that you can get it. Which is really cool if you stop and think about what Jesus' mission is. So the mission of Jesus, remember this hymn that lays out the mission and the person and all of that. The mission of Jesus, see, what did Jesus come to do? Well, he came to die for sins. Yes, we're going to get to that. But supremely, and even his dying for sins does this, what is his mission? Make God known. This is who God is. I'm revealing God. That's that. Now, the cross, we discover, is not like plan B, like God went, oh, I guess we better come up with a cross. See, if you start with a cross, you start with the wrong place. If you start with Jesus comes to make God known, then the cross means what about God? That's the kind of God God is. God is a God of the cross. He is the crucified God. He's the God who serves. He's the God who suffers. He's the God who dies. He's the God who loves. Now, think about that God in comparison to some of the other gods. Right? Right? Or even Caesar's as Lord. So we start with that revealing. Okay. Let me hand out a couple of passages here, okay? So we'll look at a few of these on deity. And Hutch, can you take Romans 14, verses 10 through 12? And then Margaret, since you're right there with him, because this will go right in hand with it, can you take Isaiah 45, verse 23? Okay? And then Rita, can you take Titus 2, verse 13. And Chris, what version have you got with you?
ESV.
Let's see how it does. 1 Timothy 3:16, of course. Okay? Could you try that for us? 1 Timothy 3:16? And that would be great. And Scott, could you take I'm going to give you the bridge one, okay? That's 1 Corinthians 2:8, okay? 1 Corinthians 2:8. Now, what we're dealing with here now is this idea of Christ.